Greetings, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome back to the podcast of Sports Scientist Nims. You are listening to the voice of Daniel. Yes, again, I'm back without an intro music. I think there's going to be a time where I'm just going to accept that I'm not going to make any intro music and I'm just going to move on without it. Actually, speaking of which, I think I'm 90% there to make the chances yet. I'm just trying and it's just frustrating. All right, anyway, so today's topic is training with the types. So while I was explaining over the overtraining syndrome in my previous podcast, I had promised that I would explain the various types of training when we went through a particular section in the podcast. So I have tried making a list out of the majorly or most widely used types of training, so there's less controversy in these types that we are going to see through. I've tried and covered almost every controversy less or, you know, less controversy type training types and all. I've also gone through various questions, frequently asked questions in various different blogs, and thanks to those content creators as well. And also, if in case you have any questions in this, or if I had missed any type and then you wanted to specifically know about it, please let me know through the Hubs forum in the page, and the link to the page is given in the description of any of the podcasts. Also, a disclaimer. Before we get in, this is going to be very dry because this is fully theoretical. I've tried to make it however easy it can sound. I've tried to minimize the amount of technical terms that has to come in. But again, this might not be the very interesting topic to listen to when you're driving or stuff. I'd like to just suggest this, that if you can make this easy, you can imagine yourself on the ground and then like imagine yourself doing each of the forms of training. All right, and also I've added a tabular column at the very end of the blog. The link is still in the description. You can go and check it out. That would make it easier for you, as you can keep it handy and then make use of it whenever you would want. So without any further ado and delays, we'll get right into the topics, which is training with the types. So first one is fartlek training. Fartlek is a Swedish word meaning speed play. It is a type of aerobic exercise, and it's often a combination of interval, continuous, and long slow distance runnings. It involves short bouts of alternate fast and slow running sessions. One of the interesting features of the fartlek training is that it does not require systematic manipulation of the exercise and the intervals, that's the recovery intervals. It rather should be interpreted with the rate of perceived exertion values, or even sometimes a box scale, whatever is available at your disposal, you can use that. This feature makes room for the adjustments in designing a protocol with accordance to the individuality principle of the training. It can be assumed that if focused and applied properly, it can challenge all three systems of your body and improve the performance level of the athlete at an immensely great level markers. It can also be used with full benefits for the athletes who are experiencing the overtraining syndrome. Since it provides general conditioning and aerobic fitness, it's also an ideal choice for an off-season or recreational fitness as well. This type of training allows the athlete to add a bit of freedom and variety to his workouts. Though the fartlek training design is pretty simple and it's widely compatible amongst all types of sports, there are also a few considerations to look into. It's highly energy demanding, and it must not be done too much. According to the guidelines of the principal designers, it is well enough to do just one session per week schedule if you're doing on fartleks. The intensity and duration must also be maintained throughout the workout. The guidelines recommended training at approximately around 70% of the VO2 max, and the effects and responses are also quite similar, and they are as follows. So It increases VO2 max, ultimately the aerobic capacity. It increases anaerobic metabolism as well because you have a speed plane between. It improves the running economy in a great deal. And pulmonary responses will include increased minute ventilation and increased oxygen delivery. And muscular responses, it does not increase the fiber density, but somehow improves the pre-existing fiber's potential. I have also, I'm not very clear how it improvises, but I'm assuming it targets the muscle recruitment systems and then improvises the ultimate. So let's move on to the second one. That's interval training. Interval training is an incorporation of repeated bouts of high to moderate intensity exercises interspaced with periods of rest. Sometimes it can also be reduced intensity. It necessarily is not always active rest or zero rest. With correct spacing between exercises and rest intervals, one can perform extraordinary amounts of intense physical activities level. It's very stressful as it involves training it closer to the limits of VO2 max, obviously, but training closer to the levels of VO2 max for a longer period of time improves the aerobic capacity ultimately. Since it's a highly stressful form of training, again, it should be very sparingly used. And again, it's also advised that this must not be used until and unless a strong aerobic endurance levels are established. The work to rest ratio is entirely dependent on the energy system that the sport requires, and so it's highly modifiable. If these work to rest ratios are maintained and performed correctly, the specific energy systems would be benefited to greater extents, and also increases the cardiovascular and respiratory system responses. So it directly promotes the oxygen delivery functions or capacity. So it is recommended that the training is performed only 1 to 2 days per week and an intensity that's pretty close to VO2 max. The important considerations to look into are the intensity of the exercise interval, the duration of the exercise interval, the duration of the rest period, and the number of repetitions, that's the relief intervals. And the muscular responses depends on the intensity. For instance, if it's a high intensity short exercises, then it promotes the recruitment of type 2 muscle fibers. And if it's a low intensity long exercises, it obviously promotes the recruitment of the type 1 muscle fibers. So, and again, yeah, work to rest ratio is also a very important thing. So as mentioned earlier, the work to rest ratios are the deciding factors of the targeting energy system. So the energy system being demanded would be based on the work to rest ratios. And these are the following works to rest ratios prescribed in most of the literature works. So immediate energy system is, if you want to target the immediate energy system, then the work to rest ratio should be 1:3. That's if you do 1 minute of work, then you should take 3 minutes of rest. And if you want to focus on the short-term glycolytic energy system, then it should be 1:2. And long-term aerobic system is 1:1. And during the rest intervals, the type of activity performed can be slow walking or slow speed jogging, and even relaxed swimming or multiple stroke swimming if the exercise is being performed on water. So coming back to the list, it's third point, so that's continuous training. So signified by the name itself, it involves continuous activity without rest. It can vary from long slow distance running or long slow type of training to high aerobic intensity running or training. The primary focus of improvement through this type of training is the oxidative and glycolytic energy systems. For slow, long distance trainings, quite similar to what we discussed in fartlek training, even in continuous training, the athlete trains closer to the 70% of their VO2 max. But for the high intensity endurance training, the athlete should train at a pace which is slightly more than their competitive pace. So, or also you can classify it as a race pace more than their lactic threshold, slightly above their lactic threshold. Training at lactate threshold itself is actually a type of training, which is explained later in this post. I've tried to briefly discuss about that, so that's also there. So if you don't know what lactate threshold is, it's coming up for you, don't worry. So this type of training can benefit the athletes from certain team sports and largely with the individual sports. It's also a very efficient method to train and lose weight. So if you are a freelancer who's doing personal training, or if you are by yourself a fitness freak who goes to the gyms and stuff, continuous training might help you lose weight. The points to consider in this method are that long, slow distances covered should not be extremely long, like insanely long. So you just have to have a maximum 100% of your distance and then work towards increasing that 100%, but it can't be like insanely long, so that has to be noted. And actually, to quantify that length, experts have advised that the distance should be greater than the competition distance, but not with high margins. This was the quotes given by few bloggers and few research articles even, so I just paraphrased it and then I put it in here. Okay, so continuous training is not very extreme in nature and can be so included, let's say, 2 to 3 days for elite athletes. And as discussed, the intensity can be close to 70% VO2 max. So few enthusiasts also suggest that it's quite equivalent to train the same at 80% maximum heart rate. So either 70% VO2 max or 80% of maximum heart rate. And the maximum heart rate can be calculated by the formula, which is maximum heart rate is equal to 220 minus the age of the athlete or age of you if you're practicing. The physiological benefits would include enhanced cardiovascular functions, enhanced thermoregulatory functions, improved mitochondrial energy production, oxidative capacity of skeletal muscles, increased utilization of fat as a fuel, so ultimately reducing body fat and ultimately reducing body weight, and also glycogen sparing and shift of type 2 muscle fibers to type 1. So there are a few types of type 2 muscle fibers, and then this system would predominantly focus on the type 2X muscle fiber, to be very precise. Alright, coming back to the list, the next we have is lactate threshold, so training at lactate threshold. So let me first give an introduction of what lactate threshold is. So this is a definition taken from the books. So that goes, lactate threshold is defined as the highest oxygen consumption or exercise intensity achieved with less than 1 millimole increase in blood lactate concentration above its normal level. That's long, so hear it back if you want to, but it's not that complicated to understand. Lactate is a byproduct formed during the anaerobic glycolysis, of course, so exercising at a slightly above the lactate threshold is an effective method of training or posting demand on the aerobic system. So the recommended running speed or pace for this kind of training, that is at which the onset of blood lactate accumulation sets in, is where you have to, firstly, initially you'll have to go to a physiological lab and then test yourself where the lactate pops in. But there is also indicative tests. I wouldn't never say that's confirmatory, but that's indicative tests where lactate threshold 1 and lactate threshold 2 are there. So that depends varying upon the conditions of the physiological expressive state of the athlete. But still, that's just an expressive test, it's not a confirmatory test. So once you train in that, it's called lactate accumulation. That's called as blood lactate accumulation period. So yeah, you might have to get yourself tested and then find your, maybe you can correlate it with your heart rate or the duration taken to achieve that heart rate and then work your way around. So there are no records of any systematic training induced changes in the heart rate blood lactate relationship, and this is why if blood lactate measurements are not possible or feasible, then we can focus on the heart rate response in the closest twin to train at lactate threshold. Also, the rate of perceived exertion, or the box scale, which we discussed earlier, serves as an effective tool to estimate the blood lactate threshold when establishing training intensity, but also it comes with a catch. The blood lactate to RPE relationship can be altered with repeated bouts of exercise, as the results can be affected due to the training adaptations to the stimulus. So, you cannot always depend on the RPE or even the heart rate to estimate your blood onset of blood lactate accumulation. So keep that in mind. It's better that you get yourself tested for a lactate accumulation period. It's not that hard, it's not that expensive, it's just a prick on the finger, so you can get yourself tested. Also, the maximum, the percentage maximum heart rate method establishes a level of exercise stress to overload the central circulation. That's the, when I talk about central circulation, it's the stroke volume, cardiac output, and those stuffs. I know these are technical terms. You probably have to look them through, but it's not that technical. It's a very easy term to learn about. Coming back. So the percentage maximum heart rate method establishes a level of exercise stress to overload the central circulation, which includes the stroke volume and the cardiac output, whereas the capability of the peripheral vasculature and active muscles to sustain steady rate aerobic metabolism dictates exercise intensity adjustments based on lactate threshold. It is advised that the blood lactate and to exercise intensity relationship should be constantly monitored and evaluated at periodic time spans. They keep changing as a result of adaptations and stuff. The exercise intensity should also be as adjusted, or let's say modified, as the performance improves. All right, that's with the lactate threshold, and let's move back to the next in the list, that is isometric strength training. So this is the last one. I know this is getting long, but let's finish it as quick as possible. So isometric strength training is very similar to resistance training, but the difference is that it's performed in a relatively static state. You don't do a movement, but then you do a static contraction. So studies indicate that this training caused tremendous strength gains, and if also to be quoted, it exceeded the strength gains of a dynamic contraction training as well. That's said in the, I too have questions on this, even I too have things to ponder about this, but that was stated in various literatures. If you don't believe me, you can go and check it out. So they say that the static contraction causes tremendous strength gains even in comparison to a dynamic contraction training. So this is a very important form of training for the core stabilization and the grip strengths and stuff. Also, they are highly helpful in post-surgery exercises and the rehabilitation and recovery exercises. So the benefits are so much in this, and the risk of injury is comparatively very low. So if you see the benefits, it provides muscle overload and improvises the strength of the muscle. The isometric method benefits the muscle testings and rehabilitations. So you don't put the patient who is post-op in full range of motion. So this helps a lot in that phase. Isometric techniques can also detect specific muscle weakness at a particular joint in a particular angle, or even in a particular range of motion of that joint, and thus it helps us to optimize the muscle overload at those specific joint angles or range of motions. Also useful for improvising core stabilizations and muscle activations. Though this study is not very profound, I have seen this in most of the hypotheses and in most of the literature works as a null hypothesis. So I'm just mentioning it here just for the knowledge purposes. Also in post-surgical rehabilitations, the limb is often immobilized over a short period of time to improvise healing, as and it is relatively incapable of dynamic contractions. So isometric trainings are very helpful in such situations. They can also contribute a lot in preventing muscle wastings and strength loss during the same period. Static contractions facilitate recovery and reduces the muscle atrophy and even strength loss at times, and also prevents edema from happening in cases of post-operative situations, if I can say it that way. There are a few limitations. Nothing comes just as a whole package. So the limitations are that it cannot be used for functional training in actual sports. And without movements, it's not actually possible to readily evaluate the overload level and the training progress of the athlete. And also, high degree of specificity affects the isometric strength development. Isometric training develops strength over a particular movement, that's over a particular joint or over a particular angle in that range of motion. So this then would necessitate the training at many specific angles through the numerous range of motions of that particular articulation and muscles. So if you were to do a bicep strengthening, so let's say you flex your elbows at 90 degrees and then hold it at that position, and then you will have to again go for 20 degrees and hold it at that position and come back and go for 110 or something and then hold back at that position. So it just increases the training time enormously high. And also this would consume a lot of training if one has to bring about a dynamic action. Just imagine the amount of work that has to be done. It's very good that this improvises your strength, but then at the cost of the time that you have to do. So that's a bargain that you have to choose. Well, that's, as I said, that's the last part. And there are other fewer types of common trainings, but again, I'm not going to go in detail because they have a lot of controversies in them. But I'm just going to name them, you know. So a few more, what I have in my mind are varying load with constant repetitions, varying loads from repetitions to failure, and constant load with repetitions to failure. Plyometrics is there, calisthenics is there, open and closed kinetic chain exercises are there, push and pull alternatives are there, and much more. There is like a plethora of types. Please do put a name of a topic that you want to know, and I would try my level best to figure out the scientific details and then report it on the blog so you can come back and read it. And also, I made a table that's been like uploaded on the blog. I know this is dry, I know this is too much of information to process, and almost it's like around 20 minutes of recording. I have not edited it right now, so it's around 20 minutes of recording. So go to the blog, have a reading. And then if you have any doubts, get back to me. You can always put it at the forums, the Hubs forum in the blog, or even you have my website and stuff back in the blog. You can also Instagram and then ask me. That would be awesome because my followers would also grow. That's just me being desperate. Yeah, I'll probably edit this or not. All right then, thank you for listening to the entire podcast. Try and share this knowledge as much as you can. I always say this, sharing the knowledge that you have would build a better tomorrow. So thank you once again, and see you until the next podcast.